Time to take a look at life along the Mississippi River with our guest, Reggie McLeod, editor of and publisher of Big River Magazine. The November-December issue was recently mailed to subscribers. I got mine in the mail. And as usual, the magazine includes many fascinating articles about all kinds of things, wildlife conservation, economic struggles of river communities. Maybe you have a connection to the Mississippi River. Maybe you live in the Driftless area, or maybe you just visit. How do you describe your quality of life in this beautiful region? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Reggie McLeod, thanks for joining us again. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, I always have a good time. Yeah, good afternoon, I should say. I'm used to saying good morning when I've been on this show.
That's right. Usually you're the first on. Well, today you're the second, and it's great to have you here. And the November-December issue, hot off the presses, and maybe just remind our listeners what the magazine is all about.
Well, since 1992, we've been covering the Mississippi River from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities, which includes the entire Wisconsin west coast on the river, and the Driftless area too, the tributaries and so on. Yeah,
it's always a pleasure for me, and there are so many stories in every issue. It's a pleasure to read. A couple of articles in the new issue note that 2024 was the 100th anniversary of the Upper Mississippi River Wildlife and Fish Refuge. Can you talk about the importance of the refuge? Extremely important.
Well, a lot of the river, if you were to travel down the river, you'd see levees on both sides, and you wouldn't really see the towns in a lot of places and houses and so on. And when the refuge was established 100 years ago, it was basically done to prevent building levee districts all along the stretch. And it goes from Rock Island, Illinois, up to Lake Pepin. So it's 261 miles of the river that was protected from that kind of development. So we have the backwaters and probably thousands of islands and back channels and marshes and all of that that wouldn't be there if they hadn't established the refuge. And it was largely the work of one man, which kind of makes it interesting. He used to take he'd spend the summers on the river and fish every day and so on, and he realized there was a big plan afoot to build levee districts, especially from around Prairie du Chien north up to Lake Pepin. And he started a campaign and started the Isaac Walton League, and it's interesting, women had just gotten the right to vote, and he got some of the major national women's groups behind him, and he got the whole thing done in about a year, which
is amazing.
Which is the most amazing thing of all. Things like that don't happen that quickly now, and they probably didn't back then either. It was quite an accomplishment. So yeah, that's what we're celebrating this year.
Yeah, his name is Will Dilg. Interesting lad. D-I-L-G. Interesting last name. You know, in September, we broadcast this show from La Crosse, and we talked then to the refuge manager, Sabrina Chandler. And she had some things to tell you about how the birthday of the refuge was celebrated.
Yeah. We worked with a bunch of groups in that whole stretch of the river and with various districts of the refuge. And they were all different sorts of celebrations. There were river cleanups and conferences and just sometimes just parties. But we brought a lot of attention on the river. You know, I've said quite a few times this year that it's something that's so big that the people who live around here don't see it. And it's kind of, we just kind of take it for granted, but you can go out there on an island and pitch a tent and stay there for a couple weeks, and you don't have to register with anybody or pay for doing that. I mean, it's this beautiful, huge public space that people enjoy in so many different ways. At this time of year, a lot of people are duck hunting and driving along the river and looking at the leaves. And it's an amazing resource, and it's a wonderful place to live too.
I want to go back to Will Dilg for a minute, because you reviewed a new documentary film titled A Visit from Will Dilg. How can people see that film?
Well, it's a little tricky now. I think Stephen Marking, who has been working as a river laureate on the big tour boats, and he grew up on the Mississippi River in Onalaska, just upstream of La Crosse, and both his parents were involved in the river a lot. And he really dug in when this whole celebration started, and he started doing a show as kind of a Will Dilg impersonator. You know how we've all seen Hal Holbrook and some of the people who do Mark Twain like that. So he did that with Will Dilg in order to tell the whole story of Dilg's relationship with the river, as well as how the refuge was established. And he's also a trained opera singer too. So he spends a lot of time on the river. He has a houseboat that he lived on that most of this last summer. But he was doing performances at a lot of these events, and he's added video to them. They were kind of a hybrid performance of video and live action. And then he used that material to develop a really, really great 50-minute film about Will Dilg. And it's beautiful. He's a very talented photographer, too. We've had quite a few covers of the magazine that were photographs that he took of the river. So he brought all those skills together and made a very informative, really interesting movie. But right now it's for sale at his performances, and I think he's working on making it available for wider distribution,
very,
so you can buy a copy.
Very, very cool. Mm-hmm. You mentioned ducks, you mentioned duck hunters, and you had an article about the duck population drop among especially the female mallards. The populations have fallen in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and talk about why that's the case.
Well, I don't know that they're absolutely sure why, but they suspect that part of it is the drought, and a lot of ducks breed in the pothole region, which is in western Iowa and Minnesota and eastern South Dakota. And because of the drought this year, some of those potholes where they nested were drying up. And because the females tend to spend, you know, more time on the nest, they were more vulnerable to predators like coyotes, which are also in this issue.
Yes.
Coyotes and other predators. So that's kind of what they're speculating. It's, you know, duck populations fluctuate a lot anyway, and part of that is they're also vulnerable during migration, and that's one of the great things about the refuge is it's the major bird migration corridor, you know, right through the middle of the country. But if you just screw up one part of that migration route, it has a big impact on those migrating birds, and sometimes I think that affects the duck population as well. But in this case, it looks like it's a combination of the drought and maybe some other things.
Yeah. Reggie McLeod, our guest, of editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in, or comments about the area. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I see there were some expansion plans for a large dairy operation in Pierce County, Wisconsin. It's causing some controversy. Some local residents say the farm intends to spread manure on fields without permission from the landowners. Talk about that for a bit.
Well, that's always been a big problem with factory farms is disposing of the manure. And some of these factory farms generate as much waste like that as a small to medium-sized city. I mean, they're large operations, and typically the way that they deal with it is they spread it on cropland as fertilizer. And those new factory farms are pretty contentious a lot of times now when they have a plan to open one. And the DNR and local officials want to know that they have sufficient land to spread the manure so it won't just pile up next to a stream and then there's a storm, it ends up in the stream in the Mississippi River. And they're discovering now that a lot of plans include certain amount of cropland to spread the manure on, but when they look at the details of these plans, sometimes the land that they say they're going to spread the manure on, they don't have a contract for that land. They haven't really worked it out. So in this case, they found that was true of the folks that were trying to get the permit. They really hadn't arranged to find enough land to spread that safely. And then safely is kind of contested because a lot of times that just washes off into the water, and a lot of times it's not really used as fertilizer because they put nitrogen on the land before they do that. So there's way more, nitrates on the land than the crops really need. And when that happens, it ends up in the groundwater and surface water and causes problems.
JP in Bluff Siding, Wisconsin. JP, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, guys. What an honor to talk to you both today. Greatly appreciate your time.
You bet. What's on your mind?
Reading the magazine, I'm not a published writer, but I am considered a mud duck over here just by Fountain City. And I noticed in the magazine that we could possibly mail in articles to you guys to possibly be in the Big River magazine. So I'm just curious today on what you guys actually look for material-wise, whether it be like historical fiction or a story, or what do you guys kind of look for to putting good content together in the magazine? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, good question. Well, the magazine covers a lot of different topics.
Yeah.
But what I usually ask people who are interested in writing is, A, are they familiar with the magazine? Do they know what sorts of things we write about and kind of our perspective on those? And then also I ask them for a writing sample of something they've done that they're particularly proud of. It doesn't even have to be about the river. I just want to kind of see how they write when they have a passion about a subject. So that's usually how we start off. We get a lot of memoir, and we don't use a lot. So, and we generally don't use poetry. So, and we try to take a journalistic slant on most of the content, too. So that's kind of a quick summary of what we look for.
Yeah, there you go, JP. Thank you so much for calling. Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Just a reminder, if you miss part of our show or you want to hear it again, or maybe you want to hear it for the first time as somebody told you about it, you can always go to our archives. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcasts, and you can search by topic or date, and they go back years. I've been around a long time, and there are a lot of old shows on there. So feel free to avail yourself. Today, we visit with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. We're talking about issues along the Mississippi River and news about the river. Join in if you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Reggie had a piece on some wetlands that are being protected, about 200 acres of wetlands, I think, along in Grant County, along the Wisconsin River.
Yeah, over by Woodman, which is upstream of Prairie du Chien a few miles. And that's a really interesting stretch. Well, the whole Wisconsin River is an interesting stretch, but along there, that's kind of right across from the confluence where the Kickapoo flows into the Wisconsin River, and there's a lot of nice wetlands in there and islands and so on, and the lower Wisconsin Riverway is just a big stretch of the Wisconsin that's mostly public land, and this just adds to it. It keeps growing, and the Kickapoo River Reserve, I think it's called, or the Kickapoo mm-hmm. Reserve. That keeps growing too. So some of these confluences are being protected more and more too. So it just expands on that. It's really a great place to canoe, and it's pretty quiet, and there's not a lot of people living in Woodman, and it's 1,400 acres of wildlife habitat. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is indeed. Conrad in Delavan has a question. Conrad, what's on your mind?
Hi. Regarding spreading the manure on the fields, is there proposed legislation going forward to make these big dairy farms use like biodigesters or create biomass fuel? Because there are technologies out there. I'm sure they don't want to spend the money to actually have the manure broken down and basically composted, so it's not such a problem with the groundwater and the soil and nature. So right now they're getting a free hand by being able to spread this manure at very little cost. I'll take my answer offline.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There was an interesting case. I don't know if it made it to the Supreme Court, but in Colorado, people were going to claim that some of this activity was actually solid waste disposal rather than agriculture. Agriculture is protected, but they were arguing that if the soil already had sufficient nutrients in it, that it was actually solid waste disposal. That case got shot down, so that didn't happen. The biogas is really interesting, and I think it's a good idea, and I think it is more trouble for people, and they tried to site one outside of Winona. I think they might still be trying to do that, and the people who live near it were concerned about the odor and the truck traffic and that kind of thing. But it is a source of energy, and it produces methane, which is what natural gas is, basically methane, that you can burn, and you could generate electricity with it, or, you know, use it as you would natural gas.
Yeah.
And then the residue that's left over is more efficient to spread and incorporate into the soil than just fresh manure would be, too. So it has a lot of benefits, but like so many things, it gets complicated when you get into the implementation.
Yeah. I think there is one, a farm that's doing that near Watertown, Wisconsin. and they're generating electricity, I think, enough for 100 homes or something like that, a large number of homes. So there, it can be done. There's no doubt about that. It can be done.
It seems more productive than just, you know, when you spread fresh manure, it evaporates, and that releases a lot of greenhouse gases, too, when it breaks down in the air like that, too. So it's not a great way of dealing with it, especially a lot of it.
You know, you had a nice story that I kind of liked, and it's got some good and some bad in it in some ways. The big boats beached by the bridge, I think, was the title of the story. Talk about that, and I thought the sort of the negative side of it was the business with the railroads, but...
Yeah, I love alliteration, actually. I had an editor once that went back to writing. He said, the only creative thing I get to do is to write headlines. So, anyway, this was really a cool story. And when Joanne first told me about it, I thought it would be good for a page. But she was River Lorien on this boat, and it was one of the large American cruise line boats, the Serenade, and they were coming upstream by Sebula, Iowa, which is across from Savannah, Illinois, and the railroad bridge there, which is an old swing bridge. Those are the ones where the bridge kind of pivots open and then pivots closed again. A part was broken or something on that, so it was really hard to open. They had to do it manually. And so the boats were stuck, a couple of the big cruise boats were stuck there. And the one boat, Serenade, pulled up by a campground. And there were a bunch of people there camping in their trailers with their boats, a bunch of river rats. And they got permission from the folks to let the passengers come out and mingle and hang out and buy T-shirts at the local marina, and it's a lovely article. I think she did a good job with it, but it was an extra benefit rather than it being a big problem of being stuck there and having to sit in the boat. It was actually something that people really enjoyed, and the weather was nice, and they learned about river life. A lot of the people on those boats are from other parts of the country,
or the world.
Or the world. And they would never get a chance to do that normally. So yeah, it was a pretty cool story. I liked it.
I liked it a lot. And on the negative side, I mean, there were some issues that the railroad was supposed to be doing but hasn't always been good about it.
Well, there's always been a struggle between the railroads and the boats, because when the first railroad bridge went across the Mississippi down in the Quad Cities, the boat pilots were worried that they'd crash the boats into the piers. And the first one that was built actually was burned down, and there was a big legal suit about the boats demanding not to be impeded on the river. But, of course, the railroads wanted to get out west, where there was a lot of lumber and a lot of settlers moving at that time. And there was a young attorney that represented the railroads, and I think his name was Abraham Lincoln. And they ended up getting the right to build the bridges, but they have to keep the river open for the boats too. And it gets kind of contentious at times. And the the railroads have a reputation of being kind of complicated to deal with.
Well. That's for sure. You mentioned Savannah, Illinois, there just a minute ago, and there's a nice, really interesting feature article in the new issue that looks at three struggling small Mississippi River towns. One of them is Savannah, Illinois. Another, Cassville, Wisconsin. And the third was Lansing, Iowa, if I'm not mistaken. What do these communities have in common?
Well, I lived in Detroit and Milwaukee and that before I moved out into rural southeastern Minnesota. And I really get claustrophobic in the cities, and I often wonder why these small towns don't have more people kind of fleeing the city and moving to these small towns, especially since, in theory, people can work on from home, you know, over the internet and so on. So we looked at these three towns a few years ago in 2020, because this was during the beginning of the pandemic, and people were speculating that because there were so many people working from their homes, that there would be a big migration to these small towns. And we picked these three because houses are really inexpensive in, well, all three of them, but especially Savannah and Cassville, because Cassville, the main employer, was a huge Army depot just outside of town there that employed thousands of people, and they closed that in 2000. And so there are still a lot of empty houses in Savannah, and it's a beautiful river town. And then Lansing doesn't have a bridge, and that's kind of pretty far from, well, no, Lansing does have a bridge. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Cassville. Cassville doesn't have a bridge, and it's a little out of the way, but they used to have two big power plants, one just right in the middle of town, and the other one upstream a little bit. And both of those power plants were closed just a couple years apart, and though they were the main employers in Cassville. And Cassville is kind of off the beaten track. It doesn't have a big highway going through it. And then Lansing, too, had the main employer closed. It used to be a place that made buttons from freshwater mussels, and they turned into a button factory and that, and they left. And so we looked at these three towns in 2020, and then we went back and looked at them this year and saw what progress they were or weren't making, and to see if there is really a renaissance occurring in these small towns. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem that there is. They're adapting in different ways and trying to be creative about it, but it's still kind of tough. And it's not just river towns, but we're a river magazine, so we focused on them. But, you know, the agricultural sector in the Driftless area, a lot of these small towns, things have become automated so much, and agriculture has changed so much that schools are closing, and, you know, it's a problem in rural America. We'll come back to these towns in a few years and do it again and see how they're doing.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of positives, at least for one of the towns, if I'm remembering, was they were kind of getting some retirees who were choosing that place to retire. So if there was any, they were kind of looking at retirees as a source.
Yeah, all three of them are to a degree, and people do that, but then the constraint there is medical care, because I think Lansing has probably done the best with that, and it's a beautiful town, and almost everyone in town is a river rat, too, which is, makes it kind of interesting. But, you know, they have to drive to La Crosse to, you know, Gunderson Clinic or Mayo for a lot of their medical care, which gets kind of difficult in the winter sometimes. And then they're building a new bridge, which has meant the old bridge has been closed intermittently this year, too. So it's tough. And I think the retirees, the baby boomers, are all retiring, and that's going to give them the opportunity to move out. But a lot of small town hospitals have closed too. So
yeah, there's that healthcare is definitely a big thing. Well, 3 years from now, you and I can sit down and talk about what's happened in the last 3 years, I guess.
Yeah, well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. It'll get a little better.
Well, there was a city well in Hastings, Minnesota, was found to be polluted with PFAS, or, you know, the forever chemicals, that were believed to originate at a 3M plant.
Yeah, 3M, this PFAS, or I don't know, is it PFAS or PFAS?
I'm not sure.
It's both of them. Both of them are a problem. 3M really had probably its biggest facilities in that stretch of the river just upstream of Hastings. And they kind of thought, well, they didn't really think it was harmless. They knew there were problems, but they kind of kept it to themselves for a while. And a lot of it ended up in landfills and so on, or just was actually just dumped into the river in wastewater. And so that whole part of the country is having problems with it. And Hastings is the most recent one. They found really high levels in some of their municipal wells, and they're trying to get help with that to get the water treated, which is very expensive to get PFAS out because it's dangerous at parts per billion. You know, I mean, it doesn't take much of it. So
yeah, it's definitely something to be concerned about. Well, you know, Lee Hendricks, I interviewed Lee for his book that he wrote, and he has a piece in your magazine. I mean, he writes often for it, but it was Steamboat Wrecker about the chain of rocks upstream of St. Louis. I found really interesting. Talk about why that was a dangerous section of the river for so many steamboats back in the early 1900s.
Yeah, there are a few parts of the river where it's rocky, where there are rapids. And the other one in our area is in the Quad Cities, and they managed to build a dam big enough to float the boats over the rapids. And in St. Louis, they were so big, or just upstream of St. Louis, that they actually built a canal to bypass those rapids. But during a lot of the year, the rocks are sticking right out of the water. You can see in some of the photos with the story. And we have people sometimes get a virus or something, and they feel like they have to paddle the entire length of the Mississippi River. And they often stop by the office, you know, or get in contact with us. And I'm surprised how many people do that without having maps or being aware of things. And I've told a couple of them, now, before you get to St. Louis, stay to the left side of the river and go around. There's a big chain of rocks there. And they didn't even, you know, the river's pretty deep down that way, and you don't expect things like that. But it's geology, you know, and that's what they had to do to fix it.
Jeff and Barry Mills, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, hello, good morning, gentlemen. Or good afternoon, I guess. Now, I just wanted to follow up with Reggie. I think it was over a year ago, maybe we talked about this Wendy's Queen riverboat that was docked across from Blackhawk Park. It was a floating restaurant. I was wondering if you ever got a chance to follow up on that.
You know, I have been trying to get some information about that ever since you talked to me about it, and I can't find any information. I should maybe just go down to Stoddard or Genoa and just walk the streets and talk to people about it, because I've been trying to find out about it. When was it open? Do you remember the years? It was the early 70s, right, or late 60s?
I had moved to Stoddard in about 76, so it had to be somewhere right around 1980, somewhere.
Really?
Between 76 and 80, yep.
Okay. Well, I'll keep at it, and if you find out anything, send it to me at Big River Post Office Box 204, Winona, Minnesota 55987. And it sounds like an interesting story, because I think you said it was only accessible by boat, correct?
Yep, they did it just like they do at the fishing barges. You pulled up a flag at Blackhawk Park, and they would come over and get you.
Yeah, no, that sounds cool. And there's not much on the other side except, you know, cropland and swamps and stuff. So So, yeah, no, I'd like to find out more about it, and we'll do a story if I can find out some more. And maybe someone who's listening will get in touch with us about that.
Yeah, for sure. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Reggie McLeod, our guest today, as we talk with him about Big River Magazine and life along the Mississippi. Questions, comments, or maybe an experience to share, give a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Just to make a mention, tomorrow on the show we talk with Craig Handel about helping groundskeeper George Toma write his biography. It's titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields, like the Super Bowl fields. Then we talk to John Greenberg, president of the Milwaukee Admirals hockey team. So we'll talk a little sports tomorrow on the show. Right now, life along the Mississippi, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Randy in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Randy.
Well, hi. Yeah, thanks. I read a book by John McPhee, and for the life of me, I can't remember the name of it because I'm old and I can't remember half the stuff I have done. This book, he talks about the river from the headwaters all the way down to Louisiana, and towards the end of the river, the story that he tells is there's a whole lot of problems in the department of engineers that would deal with that are not dealing with it because it's going to be really expensive.
Well, I think you're talking about The Control of Nature by John McPhee.
Yeah.
And he talked about the Mississippi River is accustomed to changing its course right at the end. And every 2,000 years about, it would carve a whole new path, a shorter path to the Gulf of Mexico, because as it flows out into the Gulf of Mexico, it carries a lot of sediment, and that builds up, and it makes the river longer and longer and longer. And as it does that, it's going slower and slower, and eventually it finds a shortcut that it wants to take. And it's been trying to take a shortcut to the Atchafalaya River, which branches out to the west of the Mississippi by Baton Rouge. And the Army Corps of Engineers built, I think it's called the River Control Structure. They built basically a dam on the confluence between the Atchafalaya and the Mississippi River to keep the Mississippi River from taking the shortcut, which is what it wants to do. But it would be enormously expensive because of all of the port facilities and so on that they have in New Orleans and even Baton Rouge and that stretch in between the two. So if it took that shortcut, all of that infrastructure would be pretty much useless. And they'd have to make a lot of changes on that new course along the Atchafalaya. They'd have to, you know, worry about the floods and buildings that would be underwater and so on and so forth. So they built that structure, and as time goes on, there's more and more pressure for it to go that way, and it's kind of harder and harder to contain. And when the water gets really high some years, they actually route it to the east through Lake Pontchartrain to take some of the pressure off. And everyone's worried about it. You know, it's one of those, they call it kicking the can down the road.
Yeah.
that's basically what it is. And they're still building facilities for shipping and barges and all of that in New Orleans. And that stretch, they're assuming it's going to go on forever, at least for the next 10 or 20 years. But eventually it's going to have its way, and it's going to go take the shortcut.
Yeah. Randy, thanks a lot for calling. That was an interesting little sidelight to this.
Yeah.
Philip in Trempolo. We'll go to you now. Hi, Philip.
Hello. So talking about the rocks along the Mississippi River, I haven't thought about this in years, but when I worked on the towboats in the 70s and 80s, we used to be awakened by the captain as we went through those rock cuts because it was so risky to get through there safely, even with the modern towboats. But I just remembered all of those nights that I might be asleep and the watch would wake you up and you'd have to stay up in the wheelhouse and kind of look for the captain as you were going through.
No.
Really? Well, was it at the chain of rocks then? Or?
Yep, it was a chain of rocks.
Oh, okay. Yeah, when the floodwaters are high, and of course the water on the Mississippi normally, you know, can fluctuate by 10 or 20 feet. So if you have rocks sticking out of the water and then it's, you know, 15 feet higher, a towboat can go over that safely. But it's still tricky, as I understand it. And Lee, who wrote the story, he's an accomplished pilot, and he said he wouldn't want to try it. So yeah. Did you guys have your life jackets on when you were up there in the pilot house? Or?
Oh yeah. It was everyone had to get their life jackets, and you had to actually stand on the side of the wheelhouse and talk to the pilot as he was going. And saying, yeah, one guy was responsible for calling out how close the stern was to the rocks.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Oh.
But fun.
Yeah. And Philip, just in passing, you might be interested, if you haven't read Lee Hendrick's book, and I'm forgetting the title of it now.
Oh, Peep Light. Is that it? Gosh.
Well, look up Lee Hendrick's, Philip, and he wrote a book about his life on a towboat. It's sort of a history of his time on towboats, and I think you'd find it interesting. Peep Light, yeah.
Peep Light, yeah, yeah.
The title of the book is Peep Light.
Yeah, he's a good writer, good storyteller, and he's piloted those big passenger boats as well as towboats. And he was a pilot on the biggest towboat on the river, which is an Army Corps towboat called the MV Mississippi, which is so big they have a banquet room in it. It's like, it's wild. And yeah.
It's an interesting book for sure. We talked about it. Actually, you could go back to one of our old shows, if you write his name in, it'll probably pop up in the search engine, and you could listen to the interview I had with him a year or two back now about the book. Anyway,
yeah.
Philip, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. I want to get to, I think your longest story is the one you wrote in your book, in your magazine, about coyotes in the Driftless area. I found it very interesting.
Yeah, I did too. I had lived with them and heard them a lot of times out in the country. And when I started digging around, the thing that most surprised me is they're not native to this area. They have just come up here recently. And in like the 1960s and 1970s, they were migrating in here. So they're kind of an alien species, but they've become a native species. I mean, they fit right in, but they weren't here because the wolves and I don't know how many mountain lions there were around here, but there were definitely a lot of wolves. They kept them out. You know, they're mortal enemies. But once the wolves were pretty much wiped out, the coyotes moved all across the country. They're out on the East Coast, and that was interesting. And the other thing is how they breed with wolves and dogs, and when you get out east, a lot of them are different colors and different sizes, and now that they can look at DNA, and I didn't do a lot about this, but I read some papers about it, they find that they got their red hair from from dogs, and they got these different characteristics from, they're basically almost the same species. You know, they're actually three different species, but they kind of overlap a bit genetically, and I found that interesting too. But they're very smart, very, very adaptable. I mean, there's a big difference between living in the desert and living in Ontario, you know, and but they do it. They're quite successful at it.
And there have been a few incidences of coyotes biting people, but not a ton, I don't think.
No, not around here especially. And there's a lot of them in Madison, Larry, so be
yes.
careful when you're out riding your bike. But no, they really, there are almost no reports of attacks on humans in the Midwest. There was a young woman who was killed by a couple of coyotes out on the East Coast a few years ago, a musician. And that's kind of a mystery as to why that happened, because it's really an unusual occurrence.
I wanted to talk about, in the last couple of minutes, about the future of the magazine. You're raising some money to move Big River magazines to a nonprofit ownership model. How's your, and you have a $150,000 goal. How's that all going?
Slow. it's so complicated. We finally got the last papers filed where we can directly raise money. We've been doing it through a fiscal agent. We just got the final determination on that like about a week ago. And so now we can really ramp it up a lot more. We've been kind of holding back until we had all that in order. But we're going to, the nonprofit exists and it has raised some money. And we've gotten good support, but when they reach a certain threshold, it'll actually be $75,000 when it'll buy all the assets of the magazine, and they'll be transferred to the nonprofit. And all the employees will be hired by the nonprofit. We're going to be in the same offices and the same accounts and everything. It's just going to become a nonprofit. And we have a really good board of directors with a lot of experience on river issues and grant writing. And we have one of the guys was in charge of water quality in the Mississippi River for the Wisconsin DNR. And it's exciting. And I think it's going to allow us to do some things that we couldn't do before, do more in-depth reporting, and maybe do some more things that will reach kids. And like your archives, we want to create an archive of all our back issues on the web that'll be searchable so people can go back 32 years. This current issue completed 32 years of publishing, so it's a lot of content.
That's an amazing, amazing what should I say? It's an achievement. For you, Reggie.
Yeah, thank you. It's been quite a trip, but yeah.
I was trying to find somebody had. I think there's like about 6,000 segments in my time here that we have back issues that are podcasts. So.
Yeah, well, you're doing two a day, cranking them on. You do a great job, too. I mean, the span of the things that you cover on there is amazing. Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure, as always, Reggie. I really enjoy, and we did not cover everything in the magazine, for sure. There's a lot more in it, and I always appreciate your visits, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Me too. Well, thank you, Larry.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. It's always great to have him with us. And thank you for listening. Listen, and all our shows are really a team effort. We had producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And I'm the guy that's usually on the air, most of the time anyway, Larry Mueller. I thank you all for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.